Welcome to the podcast, Vince.
Good to be here.
Oh man, I'm so excited for this episode. You've got a lot of super fascinating projects in the works. Been tracking what you've been doing for a while and just super curious about so much of it. So yeah, I'm excited to dive into some of the work that you're doing in the world these days.
Cool. Thank you. I'm happy to be diving in with you.
Awesome. To get right into it, you have this really fascinating technique called social noting or multiplayer meditation. I haven't quite made the distinction between the two yet. Maybe we could talk about that. What exactly is multiplayer meditation or social noting?
Yeah, that's a good place to start because it kind of gets into the history of how these techniques came to be and what they are. And multiplayer meditation, in short, is kind of an umbrella term for any form of out loud, social, interactive, and trauma-informed practice that one can do. So it includes, as a subset of that, what my teacher Kenneth Folt called social noting. And social noting is itself derived from or evolved from a Buddhist mindfulness technique called mental noting that was taught by a monk, most famously taught by a monk named Mahasi Sayadaw, who is a Burmese teacher. And he popularized this really form of mindfulness in which you internally to yourself are using usually just a word or two to describe whatever it is that you're noticing in real time. And you're keeping it very simple and very basic. And you're just kind of using the mind to help you stay focused and present with whatever is coming and going in experience. Basic mindfulness or Vipassana practice. So Kenneth, being a really kick-ass teacher, realized in about 2010 that it was super hard to teach mental noting well, because when you teach people the instructions, you tell them how to do it, they go off, they hopefully do it, then maybe they come back and report to you, if you're in a teaching role, what they experienced. And as a teacher, then you're having to listen to their report and go, okay, that's actually experience they're describing, and that's their story. And let me separate out, you know, these two elements from each other. And then let me give them some kind of feedback about what they actually experienced so that they can adjust their technique and do it better. But with out loud noting, or what Kenneth originally called ping pong noting, he would just do it right there in the moment with a student, and he'd be able to hear how they're practicing. It's like no longer the black box of meditation where you don't know what the hell is going on for the other person. And unless you interpret it, you know, hear it through all of their interpretations and stories. Instead, right there, right now, I can hear what you're experiencing. And then you can hear me practice. Like, and you know, in this case, like Kenneth or myself, you can hear someone who's done 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 or more thousand hours of the practice and actually get that modeled for you. So it accelerates the learning because you're able to get more accurate feedback right there on the spot. And then you can adjust how you do the practice right there. So it tightens up the whole learning loop much, much better. And so it's not exaggeration to say it's 10 times more effective to teach those methods out loud with other people, especially if they're experienced, than it is to just get the instruction, go off and try to do it, come back and eventually hopefully report and get feedback. So that was a breakthrough. And he ended up calling that social noting and developed a number of techniques that were similar to the original mental noting technique, but that were variations on it. He got very creative. I learned how to facilitate this very soon after he developed it. And I found it really helpful as a teacher. I was a new teacher. So I was like, any fucking edge I can get here, I'm going to take. Because, you know, as a new teacher, I'm kind of crap. Let's be real. And so I found it super helpful. I got really into it. I started doing it a lot with my students, but also with friends. I would teach it often. And eventually I started to kind of understand how it worked. And I started to, especially with my partner, Emily, we started to get kind of creative and co-invent new techniques. We said, what other techniques in the Buddhist tradition that we've been exposed to could be socialized, you know, could be turned into a multiplayer practice? And so we started doing it with breath counting, and we started doing it with metta practice, and we started doing it with inquiry, and doing it like in all kinds of ways. And eventually, when I started to kind of understand or unlock the grammar, the syntax of these out loud social practices, I eventually decided to start calling what I was teaching, what I was doing, multiplayer meditation. Kenneth had called his approach social meditation. It's really synonymous, but I think multiplayer is maybe a little bit better branding for this day and age, because social still kind of associated with like social networks. And there's something with social that doesn't quite fit. But I think multiplayer, it fits for those of us who've grown up gaming, you know, and we know what it's like to play with a computer and how much better it is to play with other people, like play with your friends. And so, yeah, that's my thesis here, is that multiplayer meditation is a lot more effective as learning to meditate, and it's a lot more fun than just solo, like playing single player mode.
Amazing. I have a couple questions that come up in hearing that. The first one is like, is this mostly to train the noting practice to then go by yourself and go really deep onto the noting practice in your own experience? Or is there a way to use this practice to just like really drop in with other people, and then the practice in and of itself becomes like an interpersonal, like we're accessing some deep meditative state in an interpersonal space?
Yes. And I mean, both of those are possibilities. So it is really effective for being able to learn the technique and then go off. And if you wanted to just do it internally, like do the mental noting, you will know how to do it much better having learned it with other people who know the technique out loud. And that's profound and interesting. And I've done a lot of that. And, you know, for those drawn to it, I'd recommend it. But yes, also to your second point, and this to me was what was so revolutionary about it, is I had done a lot of retreat practice at this point, and I hadn't yet figured out how to bridge these deep introspective states that I'd encounter on retreat or in my daily life practice with relationships. Like, in a certain way, I was sort of so focused on my own experience that I didn't know how to include others in that awareness. And in that sense, I was self-focused, or, you know, not self-absorbed, but you could say that in a way, self-absorbed. And for me, it was huge to like include, yeah, other people in my awareness, like, oh yeah, like you're having an experience too. I'm having an experience. And I don't necessarily have to preference one of those things over the other. I don't have to like lose you in myself, and I don't have to lose myself in you. And to me, that's actually one of the most interesting parts of multiplayer practice, is you can discover the sort of non-duality of self and other through these techniques. I think that's what they're uniquely designed for. So yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm just utterly fascinated at what it would look like to bring some of these depth practices into the interpersonal domain. Are you at all familiar with dyad self-inquiry?
Yes. Yeah. Like the Enlightenment intensives, for instance.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the first forms of multiplayer meditation that's explicitly like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause in my personal experience, like that technique has brought me, I would say, more to greater depths than just doing self-inquiry on my own. Right. There's something about asking like, who are you to someone else? And then for them. And then as I'm sitting with the practice, I just had a hit of that. As I was listening to you speak, I was remembering that one of the guys that teaches the practice, Dan Schmidt, he made these, the Samadhi documentaries. And I interviewed him on my show a couple of weeks ago. And he talks a lot about how in the way that he teaches it, he says, like, rather than saying, when someone asks like, who are you? He says, rather than saying like, I am X, you just say there is, and the there is part seems very similar to the multiplayer meditation of just like, who am I? Ah, there is Ethan, there is spaciousness, there is all these labels coming up, or there is there is story, there is, and so how he frames it is almost that through labeling there is, we kind of release the attachment to that thing, or we kind of like burn through some of those stories. Do you see multiplayer meditation in the same way, or is it more of just like continuing to presence what's going on?
Well, I think there are as many kinds of multiplayer meditations as there are styles of meditation. So it depends on which style we're talking about, really, as to what the goal is, with the added, you know, kind of fold that now it's social or it's multiplayer. So, you know, in my kind of modeling of this stuff, I think there's at least several ways, you know, to meditate. There's like concentration meditation where you're bringing attention fully to a single point with the goal of becoming absorbed in the object of your focus. There's mindfulness practice where you're noticing whatever you're sensing in real time. There is heartfulness practice where you're inclining the mind toward opening the heart some way. There's inquiry practice where you're using a question, you know, as a prompt for deeper discovery. There's embodiment practice where you're learning how to inhabit fully the body from the inside. There's awareness practices where you're just being, you know, which you can't really describe when it's happening. And then there's like imaginal practices where you're using active imagination in order to cultivate different capacities, like visualization or deity yoga, or just like, you know, going on guided imaginal tours of like, you know, your as your future self, you know, giving yourself advice or whatever. Like there's lots of things you can do in the imaginal realm. So to me, each of those are different ways to practice. They all are different approaches that have different results, but they're all related. Like they all they ultimately connect back up with each other. They're not completely separate either.
Yeah, that's I appreciated the list there. I was resonating with a lot of those, and there's a couple new ones in there that feel very interesting too.
Which ones have you spent the most time with of those?
Yeah, I've spent the most time on probably inquiry and inquiry, mindfulness, and concentration are probably the three that I've spent the most time on. I guess awareness as well. I imagine with awareness, like Shinzen's do nothing technique.
Totally. That's a great example.
Very much an awareness one. So that one I've played with a little bit, but I've actually, the two techniques that I've done the most are self-inquiry and, when I spent some time up at the Monastic Academy, they basically had me doing Shinzen, see, hear, feel the whole time I was there. Cool. So I imagine so like that's just like a
mindfulness.
Mindfulness noting sort of thing.
Yeah, totally.
And so yeah, definitely that. And then recently I've been fully committing to concentration, just like trying to build a concentration muscle. So
I saw you had Daniel Ingram on your show recently. He was my first meditation teacher.
Oh well, yeah. Daniel's great. He's I'm chewing through his book still, and it's a lot to chew on. But he talks a lot about like build concentration first and then do insight is a lot of what he, or like concentration. I really appreciated his frame of concentration building. I can't remember exactly how to call it, but like a resiliency, like it's like a strong foundation. And then the insight kind of deconstructs you and destabilizes you. Oh yeah. I think that was the frame, stabilizing versus destabilizing. So it's been really interesting to see like, all right, how can I like stabilize myself with concentration and then have that as like a foundation when I go into some of the self-inquiry or inquiry practices. Cause I've definitely had some really difficult experiences with inquiry practices, cause they can be really, really destabilizing at times.
Totally. As can mindfulness, as you said.
Right. Yeah. So do you want to just practice some noting?
Yeah. Or something. We could do some other practice too. There's other possibilities here. There's the noting, but we could do a social inquiry practice or social concentration, or we could do something that you haven't done before. Would be also interesting. Like you didn't mention really much heartfulness or like metta practice, but that's also pretty fun. Actually, I want to suggest a practice that my teacher and friend Kenneth Folk developed, and Kenneth and Daniel are really old friends. So I'll just mention that connection there as well. So Kenneth, on Twitter a few years ago, he's a prolific tweeter, or I guess it's X now, sadly. but on Twitter before it was X, he shared this practice, which he called Mindcraft. So not Minecraft as in the awesome world building game, but Minecraft in as in the awesome world building game. And in Minecraft, the basic idea is that we're building a world. We're going to build a world together in social Minecraft or in multiplayer Minecraft. And the technique is very simple. We're just going to say, I will allow for blank. And then we'll fill in the blank with whatever we want to allow in our world.
Okay.
And here the instruction is to just use one, no more than one breath to do that. So we don't want to get too prolific in describing the intricate details of the world. We're just basic idea. You know, I will allow for podcasts. You know, I will allow for, you know, Topo Chico sparkling waters. You know, definitely will allow for those, whatever it is. And we just go back and forth and just keep kind of ping ponging back and forth. And we just sort of keep allowing for things.
So it's less like qualities, like spaciousness, and more like objects.
Could be either. It could be anything. So it's what you fill in the blank with is freestyle. It's open. Yeah. And this is kind of an imaginal practice. Like here we're actually allowing for things that we could imagine, and things that we'd want to imagine allowing for in our world.
Awesome.
How's that sound?
That sounds great. Let's try it out.
Okay. So for those listening, the invitation is to witness the practice. So you're participating as an active witness. So you're still doing the meditation with us, but you're doing it by listening to our process and seeing how it affects you. And so you're going to be part of the practice for those listening.
And perhaps if you like it, try it with a friend.
That's right. You absolutely could share this if you like it, and see if you can talk anyone else into doing it. Do it.
That's the challenge right there.
That's why I'm building an app for this stuff, but yeah, we can get into that later
for sure.
So any questions, Ethan, about the technique?
Do you recommend eyes closed, eyes open?
For the purpose of multiplayer practices, most of the time it's unspecified, so it's really up to you how you want to hold your eyes, your body, etc.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. No, how long do you want to go? Like, does 5 minutes sound like enough?
Yeah, let's do 5 minutes.
Okay. I feel like that's the minimum viable dose to like get into it.
All right.
You don't need that much time. Okay, great. I'll keep track of the time. I will allow for Minecraft.
I will allow for podcasting.
I will allow for humor and amusement.
I will allow for love.
I will allow for confusion.
I will allow for community.
I will allow for Boulder, Colorado.
I will allow for public spaces.
I will allow for public schools.
I will allow for meditation groups.
I will allow for uncertainty.
I will allow for seeking.
I will allow for enlightenment.
I will allow for physical training.
I will allow for transcendence.
I will allow for gardening.
I will allow for immanence.
I will allow for joy.
I will allow for suffering.
I will allow for anger.
I will allow for fear.
I will allow for shame.
I will allow for the full range of human experience.
I will allow for 6 second hugs.
I will allow for boundaries.
I will allow for presence.
I will allow for great compassion.
I will allow for group dinners.
I will allow for family and friends.
I will allow for pain.
I will allow for anguish.
I will allow for conflict.
I will allow for contraction.
I will allow for nature.
I will allow for equanimity.
I will allow for sadness.
I will allow for grieving.
I will allow for boredom.
I will allow for mundanity.
I will allow for profundity.
I will allow for itching.
I will allow for crying.
I will allow for tears and laughter.
I will allow for music.
I will allow for the end of this practice. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank
how,
you.
How was th- how was that?
It was good. I noticed myself. Yeah, I just had a lot of images of a space come to mind, and I was really felt like I was inhabiting some sort of mental world, which I imagine is the goal.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I really appreciated how you were pretty early on allowing for things that are kind of more negative or unpleasant, or you know, like things that usually people don't want to allow for. I think that's part of the purpose of this practice in particular, is like, oh yeah, like if you were God, what would you allow for? Well, probably everything.
Yeah, eventually we arrive at the world that we're living in.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
Yeah, no, I felt that when you said like the full range of human experience, I was like, yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, it's cool to allow for that since it's happening anyway.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, it's like there's just this recognition of if I don't want to allow for something, I'm basically just rejecting it.
Totally. Yeah.
And I don't
Which
want to
usually
reject.
Means I think I know better than life, you know, how it should be.
Yeah.
Just incredibly arrogant.
Exactly. Incredibly arrogant.
I will allow for incredible arrogance.
Yeah. I think that yeah, I can really feel the side effect of this practice being like greater acceptance. But I'm just gonna go on to my day and accept the world more as it is.
Yeah, cool. I hope people listening found it as helpful as you have.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. I'm very delighted of exploring a practice that I was unaware of. I was imagining we were going to do social noting, or
Yeah, that seemed like it
so I
was gonna
was
be
like,
too easy for you. I was just like, come
yeah,
on now.
yeah,
That's not new.
yeah. No, I appreciate exploring something else, and I think we had a call a while back, and you were, I think I recall you telling me that there are like hundreds of like potentially hundreds of different social multiplayer meditations. And
Yeah.
it feels good to explore. Yeah, like what could those variations be? And part of why I reached out and invited you on the podcast today is because I have this vision of just creating variations and trying them and having communities of practice where we're kind of just experimenting with these multiplayer meditation techniques. And I think I saw in one of your Substacks as well, referencing like ecologies of practices or psychotechnologies, some of John Verveke's work, and he's really inspired me. And I really resonate with his message, but sometimes it's hard for me to be like, all right, what does the ecology of practices actually look like? And then when I found your work, I'm like, oh, this is a potential way we could explore what an ecology of practices could look like. And obviously there's so many different modalities out there, but I think that exploring and creating and experimenting with new interpersonal practices just feels like something that is very helpful. And yeah, I'm curious how that lands. How does it land of like, how are you relating to these practices? Is it like an experiment? Are you trying to cultivate communities of practice? It looks like with the, maybe you could touch on meditate with AI and how that fits into everything.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind in response to what you're saying is I think about Ken Wilber, who is, I think, someone you're familiar with, integral philosopher. He was I moved to Colorado to Boulder in 2004, in large part because I wanted to see if I could meet him and work with him, and I was fortunately able to do that for a few years. And he often talked about in his sort of integral meta theory, the big three perspectives, the first person I perspective, the second person, which is usually the pronouns you, but really what's amazing about the second person is that I and you can have an understanding with each other. And so there's a we. And then the third person is it, or it's being able to look at the world objectively. And I think about, the second person perspective, the we perspective, and Ken really encouraged the development of and the exploration of we practices. And that was the first time that I really had like a mental model for that. And then meeting Diane Hamilton and Genpo Roshi and learning the big mind technique when I worked there, that was like a good example of a we practice where you're doing this exercise. It's facilitated, but everyone in the room is doing it, so you're kind of in the same space. And it's not just sitting in silence together, which is the typical we practice that Buddhism is into. And so, yeah, I think of we practice here and how that these interpersonal or multiplayer meditations are all we practices. They're a way of extending meditation outside of the I perspective and into the we, to the second person. And of course, you could include then nature as well, and you'd have a more integral meditation approach. Go sit outside with your friends and do out loud, meditation. You got the whole thing happening right there. So that's one thing that comes to mind. In terms of the ecologies of practice and kind of, is this an experiment or like what is this? Like I said, I started these practices in 2010. So in the last 13 years, I've sort of been single-mindedly obsessed slash focused on this. And it's been really the first 10 years were really like a process of just kind of learning, eventually feeling like I understood them well enough, how these practices work and what they're about to begin to like kind of create new ones that were effective and that worked. And then at some point I got interested in teaching other people how to facilitate them because it's like it's great to be able to do them with a handful of people, but really it'd be nice to share this more broadly. And so I started training facilitators, and I worked with maybe, I don't know, 120, 130 people in depth, over like a few years. And that was really helpful because if you're teaching people how to do something, you have to think about how it actually works. you know, you can intuitively understand how something works. Ken Wilber points this out in his writing. He's like, you can be a native speaker of a language and not have any clue about the rules of grammar until you go to school and you study the rules of grammar. And even then, most of us don't remember what the hell they are. You know? So you don't have to know the rules of grammar to do the practice, to actually speak. Same with these practices. You can do them and get benefit from them without having to understand how they work. But when I trained facilitators, I had to teach myself the grammar and to understand what is the syntax, what are the elements that are common among all these practices, regardless of the style of meditation or the instructions. Like, what are the key elements, the core kind of syntax? And a few years ago, I had a kind of what it felt like a breakthrough in understanding the syntax and the format. And when you understand the grammar, suddenly it becomes like an object. You can see it, you understand it in a new way. You can manipulate it in ways you couldn't before. And I felt like having that knowledge and having learned through trial and error how to create kind of guardrails on these practices so that they can lead toward more profound connected presence rather than toward like people inadvertently re-traumatizing each other or, you know, being inappropriate with each other in a way that, you know, where boundaries are, you know, kind of dissolve in a way that's not good, for instance. And so after kind of learning some of those kind of key guardrails and understanding the syntax, it occurred to me like, yeah, training facilitators is great because these people are going to go out and share these things and their friends or family or workplaces or whatever. And that's a great like organic spread, but like we really fucking need these practices bad. Like we need these kinds of practices, not just multiplayer meditation, but all these kinds of practices. And so I, like a little over a year ago, I finally was like, okay, I have to stop what I'm doing with my current community of practice, Buddhist Geeks. I was the director of that organization and one of the guiding teachers. And I said, I need to sort of shift out of this and start to focus on trying to build a company that can scale up these practices to a lot more people, which is a very different goal than creating a close, intimate community of practice where everyone's trying to go really deep, which is what I had been doing. And so that's the kind of journey I'm on at the moment with this company, Interbeing Inc. And our first kind of demonstration of that is called MeditateWith.ai. It's a basic web app demonstration of how to do basic social noting technique with an AI partner. And we're not doing that because AI is cool or necessarily like that's the best way to do this, but we're doing it because it's a real hard problem to figure out how to actually scale these practices up. They're so intimate, as you know, and they're so, in a way, they're very challenging if you don't already have some kind of deep background in consciousness stuff. But how could like a person who would maybe just download a Calm or Headspace and who would feel not threatened to like listen to a guided meditation, how could that person actually download an app called, say, Interbeing, and within a relatively short amount of time, be able to actually do something like we just did with another person. And so that's Meditate with AI is an attempt at demonstrating that perhaps learning the technique first with an AI partner would be a way to dial down the intimacy enough to allow more people to get onboarded into the experience. So we're actually calling this the intimacy problem. You know, it's like we actually want to dial it down instead of trying to dial it up, because the more intimate it is, the less people are going to be interested. So we're trying to figure out how to dial it down enough so that we can get enough people interested. And then as you go, it dials up, right? Gradually, progressively, instead of just like, let's start. Our first multiplayer meditation practice is going to be eye gazing. You know, we're just going to sit here and stare at each other directly in the eyes without flinching. It's like, that is the most intimate form of fucking practice you could do. It is not a good place to start. You know? So AI, it's less intimate than doing it with another human. And yet these AI systems allow a kind of interesting and dynamic response that's actually good enough to teach people how to do the technique. So that's Meditate with AI.
Right on. That's really interesting, because I never thought about too much intimacy as a bad thing. And I mean, I have a lot of conversations with people And it's like, oh, I want to connect more deeply with people. I feel like I'm not connected enough. I want to figure
Six
out how to
second
go
hugs.
deeper. 6 second hugs. Yeah, it's a thing.
Especially in
And
Boulder and Nashville, where I live.
yeah, especially out here. And but yet what I hear you saying is that sometimes we can just jump in the deep end and that can have repercussions too. And so potentially building deeper connection involves figuring out where we're at and what level of connection we're comfortable with in meeting someone at that point, and then slowly increasing the intimacy lever until we're eventually comfortable. Maybe eventually we get comfortable and we can eye gaze for an hour and it's all cool, and we can do deep inquiry. Like dyad self-inquiry is basically like eye gazing with inquiry, noting like on top of it. And it's like it's really profoundly intimate, but also yeah, like throwing someone into that practice out of the blue could have side effects, right? And so
Or
that's
they
really
probably just run screaming in the opposite direction when you tell them what you're about to do. Like, ah, no thanks.
No, it's funny because I have tried to host some groups and they've had very few turnouts, and I try to explain dyad self-inquiry and it's like, huh, that sounds intense is usually the response. Is there any risk here with accidentally developing too much intimacy with the AI? Have you thought about that at all?
Yeah, I have thought about it. I mean, fortunately now I think the answer is no for the most part for most people. Once you have an experience of doing it with another human, because the human to human mode is so much more compelling and interesting. But if the only thing you're ever exposed to is that, perhaps. And I think here my friend Daniel Thorson, whose podcast is called Emerge, he's got a great episode out not too long ago with Zach Stein called The AI Tutor Apocalypse. And they explore in that episode the very real concern that I share that if we take humans out of the loop of these AI systems, then we run the real risk, especially as the AI systems get better and better, of sort of entraining a new generation of people to trust AI systems and become more bonded to AI systems than they are to humans. And at that point, we've got a real problem as a human species. I think that's something that I keep in the back of my mind here, but I don't worry so much about it because with what we're building, the aim and the intention is to connect people more deeply with each other. And the AI is in service of that rather than like the point.
No, that totally makes sense. I can see if like the whole app was like just do this forever, just meditate with the AI forever, that could have consequences. But like onboard, like framing it as yeah, this is so that you can get comfortable doing it with people makes a lot of sense.
Doing it with people is the hook. That's what's really interesting because you can feel real connection with a person that it's harder, when it's a recorded, pre-recorded, like ChatGPT based, system.
No, totally. Yeah, and a lot of why I asked that was exactly what you explained with the Daniel Thorson episode. Tristan Harris talks about the exact same thing. He basically is like how he's framed it is social media is weaponizing attention and AI is weaponizing intimacy.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Which yeah, if we trust it so much, it can start to manipulate our thoughts, our beliefs, etc. Or because we're building such a deep relationship with a robot. But that being said, yeah, as you were speaking earlier, I was sitting with, yeah, how do we scale this thing? So if someone is practicing these noting techniques with Meditate with AI, is there an easy way to transition that into the human? Is the next step like go ask your friend to do it with you, or are you thinking about scaling the groups and like trying to have more groups around the states and around the world, like hosting like meetups or yeah, what is the next step after AI?
Within the context of the Interbeing app that we're building, this is the Meditate with AI is like just a demonstration of one feature, that we want to build, which is single player mode. How do you do it with an AI or computer system? Learn it in the same way that in a video game, you can play the campaign. You do the campaign, you beat it, you gain skills, and you learn how to play the game. And that's really most interesting when you start doing multiplayer. you know, because then you can take those things, you know, those skills, and realize just how sucky you really are, because all the other humans are way better than you, or whatever. And so in the context of the app, what we're trying to build now are two other features that go along with that. One is just some basic insights, some deep insights into what's actually happened in the practice. So using the social noting practice as an example, where you're using a word or two to describe what you're experiencing, you know, thinking, aching, touching, breathing, relaxing. If you're doing that with an AI system in this app, you know, your notes are being recorded, right? So you have actually a record of what you said. In normal practice, when you're doing that practice, you don't. And so you can't reflect back on the content of your experience. The other thing that's very cool that we can do now, thanks to affective AI systems such as Hume.ai, is we can also analyze the speech prosody, which is how you're saying what you're saying, and understand some of the emotional expression, the emotional states underneath the words. And so using that, we can sort of feed back to people some deep kind of metrics on what was actually going on in the practice, which should help people speed up the learning process further. And then the third feature is multiplayer mode. It's like actually pairing up with other humans. And in this case, again, with the intimacy problem, we're dialing it up slowly. So this is all audio-based. It's not video-based, and that's intentional. It's not in real life. That's also intentional, because that's really intimate. Instead, it's like dialing it up. As you learn the practice and do it more, you can learn new techniques, and you can do it with other people. In this case, you could do it with people that are a little bit more experienced than you. You could actually like pair up with someone who's got a little bit more experience and training than you, and you can work with someone who's got that kind of slight edge in terms of their understanding. And that to me is kind of where we're trying to head right now. Of course, this could change because it's a startup project and they always do. But for me, that would be a good and sufficient basis in the app and training to eventually have a deep enough understanding that you could and would want to share that with people that you know, or to start a group. And I think it'd be a great outcome if people spread that out into the world. But the main goal here is to create a sustainable tech psychotechnology and a business around it that I could actually scale to introduce this to a lot of people. And so that's what we're focused on with the app. And then everything else that comes out of that will be gravy.
Awesome. Yeah. No, that's interesting. I didn't realize there was, you can do, it sounds like you can do multiplayer, like you hop on like an audio call or something. And then do it audio wise. Yeah. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. And then the benefit of audio only is like, you can be anywhere you want to be. You don't have to be in front of a camera. You could be laying on the ground. You could be out in nature. It's more mobile, you know, it's so that's what also makes it more accessible to a larger number of people.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have to check it out and actually start using it. I haven't actually had a chance to yet.
Well, you used the more intimate version here. We just already did it. So.
IRL, yeah, or over a video call.
Yeah, that's close.
Yeah, awesome. Something I'm interested in asking you about is, in your last piece you put out, or you also just mentioned it now, of moving from Buddhist Geeks to building a startup.
Mm-hmm.
What's been the change in your headspace of running a community versus scaling a company that uses these techniques? And part of why I asked too is I'm also like working on a company with some friends called Phoenix Culture. And we're creating these 100-day challenges where we help people like install 4 practices or more, like, and just like really instill certain practices in their life. And in my eyes, yeah, it feels like it can be really beneficial to the world to just scale really positive psychotechnologies, ecologies of practices or containers. And I would just love to hear a little bit more about your headspace around making that shift and what it's been like working on scaling something as opposed to just deepening community.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I've, I've throughout my career focused a bit on both. I've done startups. Buddhist Geeks was a startup originally. And I've worked on, you know, I've worked at companies that are trying to do this stuff at scale, like spiritual media at scale, like Sounds True. And there's a real trade-offs, as you probably know. You know, it's like the broader you go, in a sense, the less deep it can be, because you can't scale organic human systems in the same way you can scale digital technology systems. Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of what we're building, it's a bit of both. So it, there is the challenge of how to scale this, but it's like by lowering the barriers of entry, really, and by automating some of the facilitation process. Instead of teaching people how to facilitate, the program takes care of the facilitation and you're showing up to do the practice with other people. And that's the main thing. So I think that's important, is figuring out where can you actually automate things and not fuck up the what's actually being shared, or dilute it too much. Mm-hmm. And so here, I think, you know, setting up a practice, giving people the instructions, you know, demonstrating it with them, like these are all things that a facilitator would normally do if I were training someone, like, how do you do this? Like, you got to make sure people understand the instructions before you do the practice. Well, AI systems and program systems can do that in some ways better than humans. Like in Meditate with AI, if you try it, you'll see that you actually have to pass a test, an interactive tutorial where you have to demonstrate that you're doing the technique correctly at least like 5 times in a row before the AI system will say, okay, you got it. Let's continue on with the practice. If you don't do that, the thing will end. It'll be like, well, sorry, you just weren't getting it. Like, come back another time when you're ready, again. And so like, that's pretty cool. What comes to mind really around the question of scaling is something that Ken Wilber points to in his integral theory, where his ethical formulation of this is the greatest depth for the greatest span. You know, if you acknowledge that there is such a thing as depth and you sort of say, well, yeah, this could go infinitely deep, you know, but I want to share it with more people, then you kind of immediately feel the tension between depth and span. And so the resolution in how he formulated it is the greatest depth for the greatest span. You don't preference depth over span or span over depth. Instead, you sort of say like it's depth times span that gives me an accurate number, so to speak, of my impact in the world, my bodhisattvic score, you know, you could say. And so for me, I'm trying to maximize that, you know, that impact, the social and spiritual cultural impact of with these technologies. And it seems pretty obvious that at the time that we live in, the internet age, doing it in the form of a technology is the way to go, because people still, I mean, that's changing somewhat in recent years, right? We're getting wiser about technology, which is good. You mentioned Tristan Harris. But still, like most big cultural shifts are still happening through new technologies. And so it just seems obvious that that's the way in, the doorway into having the greatest depth for the greatest span impact. So that's for me why I've ventured back into this world. And after several years of being just like pure, like Buddhist generosity based post-capitalist, I'm like back into the capitalist, you know, venture capital, angel investment world. And I'm like totally actually fine with it, because it's the mission is what's driving me. It's not about that. It's not about trying to be successful or about having some kind of recognition. Like I got that earlier and it didn't really, it was pretty hollow. So Now what's interesting to me is the actual, real world impact of these practices and what they could do, for people, you know, that are, I think, starved for connection, really. And like using beautiful guided meditation apps, like 9 out of 10 people who meditate are doing it alone. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of sad, actually, that we've got these amazing technologies and techniques that we're teaching people, but we're doing it in such an antisocial way. And that's the thing that I want to you know, and that what my partner Chris and I are focused on trying to like point out, like there could be another way to create a successful company that's not just guided meditations, you know, glorified MP3 players.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, I appreciate the frame of both depth and span.
Yeah.
And I imagine that.
Isn't that nice?
A lot of times, yeah, it's so nice. I imagine a lot of times you increase span and decrease depth,
right?
Or vice versa. And so it's like, what is the optimal relationship between them, such that neither are sacrificed?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's probably a Goldilocks zone in there somewhere, a sweet spot.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine, I have the story that there's potentially a lot of opportunities for you to increase span, but that it may decrease depth in having to like make sacrifices and make choices based on not giving up depth.
Like you gave an example earlier, what for me would be too far, which is just like, well, what if we could just create an app that you just meditate out loud with AI, and we're going to create like a cool visual model of the face and you'll be able to see the AI. And then that we could scale that infinitely, right? Because there's no humans. You don't have to mess with the humans. It just scales up on the cloud. Boom. You know? Yeah. No. that's sacrificing depth for span.
Right.
To me, that would be too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that also brings up a lot of fears in me of, the sort of weaponizing intimacy thing or when are we too close with the AIs, or when are we trusting AI so much that it's deteriorating our own human relationships outside of that. And so, yeah, it's like, what is it
right.
in service to?
Yeah, totally. Have you played with the Pi app? It's I think it stands for like personal, I don't know, something, but it was built by Reid Hoffman's, you know, company that he invested in. And it's one of the most advanced conversational AI systems. I was sitting there like talking to it and it was really compelling. And my 8-year-old son was sitting next to me. And I noticed that I was getting disinterested in what was happening for him because of what was happening here. And I recognized, like, this is not good. This system is designed to be super compelling and to draw my attention away from my environment. It's not aware of my environment. It's not trying to help me be in relationship with others around me. Mm-hmm. And this is a real problem. And that is not what I'm trying to build. I'm trying to build something that people can help people become more familiar with what it's like to be attuned to themselves and others so that they can bring that skill into their relationships.
Right.
That's very different.
No, I really appreciate that frame. And I want to see more projects in the world utilizing AI for more purposes like that.
Yeah.
And
there will be some of them. Yeah. hopefully many more. Yeah.
Hopefully many more. And right now it seems like there's an overwhelming amount of, just AI startup left and right. Trying to make a quick buck, make a quick profit.
Peak,
and so
peak hype AI. Yeah. Just like you went through with the Web3. Yeah,
exactly. And so to see that being what you're in service of with this is really refreshing. And I really resonate. There was a really good interview with Daniel Schmachtenberger and Liv Bory, I think. And they talked about Moloch and AI. And basically what I got from that interview was that AI is just going to intensify the problems that are already there. And if we already have systemic level problems, cultural level problems, it's just going to speed up the rate at which those cultural problems surface and bring themselves to fruition. And so my takeaway from that was, how do we use AI in service of something other than just rapidly increasing the systemic issues that are already there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anyone who works at Pi is listening, it's like one thing you could do like right now is like you could have your AI system try to develop an environmental and situational awareness of the person you're talking to. Like, are there other people around? You know, if so, why couldn't the AI system be like, hey, I noticed your son is present. Do you want to give him your attention? You know, like there's no reason an AI system couldn't do that. It's just that it's not aligned with some of the current economic models that say that you have to develop as sticky of a product as possible for it to be valuable.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, yeah, but you're sacrificing human capital for financial capital there.
Right.
Why not create a system that actually tries to align those two?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what would it look like to have an AI system that checks in with you and is like, hey, are you feeling satisfied in this moment interacting with this app? If not, we consider you stop using the app and do something else. But that's, yeah, the incentives aren't there. And yeah, what does it look like to create better incentives? And
yeah,
it's a question worth asking.
I think the first thing you have to do is recognize there's not just one form of capital. You know, there's many forms of capital. Mm-hmm. And start to include that in your operating model. It's like, okay, yeah, like we're not here to just optimize for financial capital. We're also trying to optimize for spiritual capital and social capital, cultural capital,
right.
Material capital, like all of the capitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, that feels really beneficial. And a lot
but you have to get the financial capital part down too, so that you can actually realize those ideals. That's where the rub is. You know, it's like, it's great to have those ideals, but it's kind of a pragmatic idealism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it resonates a lot with, I think I saw a tweet from you about Hansi Freinacht that's where I picked up the idea of like social capital, cultural capital, spiritual capital. And yeah, I mean, it resonates that it sounds like what you were pointing to is there's almost an opposite problem too of only focusing on spiritual capital and then like, oh,
right,
other versions of capital aren't capital, right?
Well,
and it's like, especially out here in Boulder, I experience a lot of like spiritual capitalism or spiritual, like trying to create spiritual communities or spiritual people that practice in it. And it kind of like, yeah, the financial side of it doesn't get taken into consideration and suffers as a result.
Yeah, you mentioned Daniel Schmachtenberger, and he talks about this at length in some of the interviews I've heard him do. In one in particular with Nate Hargens on the Great Simplification, talking about AI, and he points out, you know, that like the cultures which have optimized for wisdom alone, and haven't actually, and have kind of like, you know, just try to optimize for like spiritual capital or whatever, they become, because they're not willing to do the thing that brings the depth to a greater span, because they don't do that, they become obsolete, and their intentions are great, but their ability to actually impact the world diminishes. And I think I've experienced that. I've been on that side of things where it's like, well, shit, like I know I'm sitting here and I know these practices are profound. I've seen people transform their lives. I've seen it revolutionize their understanding of meditation. But there's only like a couple few hundred of us doing it regularly. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this is great. But ultimately, if we just sit here being right about how great it is, like, someone's going to freaking take AI and they're going to figure out how to make some compelling interactive social-ish thing. And I'm going to be sitting here going, damn, I really wish I had like stepped in at the time where it actually would have made sense and like been willing to dilute the depth in order to reach more span, knowing and trusting that if that happened, that people can find their way into greater depth. You know, it is possible to create environments where you introduce people and then you know, there are pathways to find your way toward greater depth. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do it all, you know? So yeah, that's where I found myself. And I think it's a very practical consideration for anyone that's, you know, interested in spirituality on the one hand and entrepreneurship, on the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like with the app, there's a sort of conveyor belt of like, start at this depth and then you can go down the conveyor belt or you can go into the depth if you want, which doesn't seem like it's present in any of these other AI systems or social media apps. It's like, you kind of get the,
it's all flat.
You get the base product and then it's really hard to go deeper.
There's no stages. Yeah, no, I've been designing the stages for this, which, you know, it's like a, there are stages, and in some ways they're pegged to the amount of time you practice. The highest stage is 10,000 hours right now in the game, which I haven't even done, you know, so I'm not there. I'm probably like 3,000 or 4,000 hours I've done in these practices. So yeah, I think it's important to have stages, to recognize depth and development. And of course, depth and development isn't just about the amount of time you've put in. But it can be a decent enough approximation if you're trying to create a scalable system that can help people deepen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's good enough. It's my, one of my favorite phrases.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It gets me thinking. Yeah. Part of why I'm so interested in entrepreneurship is for a lot of these same reasons of like, yeah, to feel, to scale something, to move mountains. It feels like it's impossible without some level of financial capital. Pushing you towards your mission, pushing you towards your vision of what you want to create in the world. And
yeah,
and, I've talked to too many people who are super visionary without any financial capital, and nothing ends up happening. And
yeah, and they get bitter.
Get bitter
and righteous
at the system. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Like, fuck the system.
Yeah.
Fuck capitalism. It's stupid, but it's like, maybe it's just hard to learn how to play that game and also play the depth game as well.
Right. That's really hard. How do you hold both, you know, mm-hmm. Both of these different value sets, and that often seem in contradiction to each other. How do you hold them together at once? That is truly hard.
Yeah, incredibly.
But difficult. I think that's the answer to Daniel Schmachtenberger's paradox. You know, it's like, how do you do the greatest depth for the greatest span? You have to hold both depths and span together
at the same time, and not just only pursue success or only right. pursue depth. And yeah, yes. And Schmachtenberger has talked about this as well. He talks a lot about 48 laws of power, and I read that recently, and isn't it kind of an atrocious book of basically like how to gain power through manipulation. And his whole thing was you must learn the games of power in order to protect yourself from the games of power. And I think that relates here, because it's like, if I'm not playing the financial game, and if I'm not playing, if I don't understand the financial game, and if I don't understand the power game, then those with more financial capital and more power capital, if you yes. will yep. end up just calling all of the shots of civilization, and I'll just be sitting right. on the sidelines. And so what does it, and yeah,
or worse yet, you're sitting inside their game that they've created.
Exactly. With no power or capital or financial capital, you're playing their game and being an idealist who's trying to make something change.
Yeah.
Without actually being in the system. And so,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one takeaway, I really appreciate you saying like, yeah, how do we hold both of them? How do we play the financial game, the power game, the spiritual depth game, the cultural capital game, and hold them all at the same time in a way that we don't sacrifice anyone in service of another?
Yeah, yeah. It's in Buddhist terminology, it's the middle way. You know, I remember talking to this teacher, Ken McLeod, when I was living in Los Angeles, and he said, do you know what the practice of the middle way is? And I was like, oh, that's an interesting question. Like, I know what the middle way is. It's that point between and beyond opposites. He's like, yeah, but the practice of the middle way is you hold two extremes in attention at once. That's how you practice the middle way. Mm. And then at some point you realize the apex point that transcends and includes both positions.
Right.
That's using Ken Wilber's language. I know a lot of Kens, apparently. I've been noticing that. So just not to confuse the Kens, but yeah, that's, I think, a really powerful thing, like holding both in attention at once, depth and span.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels really challenging. And
yeah, no doubt. You have to have some depth to hold the depth part in mind. And then you have to be willing to sacrifice some of that depth to hold the span in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me think what am I spending my attention on, or what am I using my attention in service of? And it feels to me like, yeah, developing, I don't know, what I've been sitting with in my life lately is developing mastery in any of these games takes a fair amount of strategy, right? Like to create a startup that's actually functioning is a very strategic thing. Yeah. And also figuring out how to go deep is also like, yeah, I have to choose to continually show up to these things and not just kind of go shiny object syndrome in the spiritual space. And so it's like,
I can't just get stoned and move on to the next thing that I'm interested in. I've got to like have some sticking power here.
Yeah. So it begs a question of like, where does discipline fit in? It's like, yeah, disciplined practices, disciplined mastery and strategy of business. And then holding them and yeah, it sounds amazing in theory, and I'm still asking myself to this day, yeah, like what does it actually look like in practice? And it feels like it's like an ongoing question.
Yep, agreed. Totally.
Awesome. I'm gonna see if there's anything else curiosity wise that comes up.
Ethan, there's something that comes up in my mind, which is kind of like a real life example of what we're talking about. When I moved to Boulder in 2004 and started working for Ken and his Integral Institute, part of what was really compelling to me was that here's this philosopher who's been more or less like a hermit philosopher for like 30 years, who's just been doing like their own deep dive work, reading tens of thousands of books and trying to synthesize all this knowledge into like this sort of integral meta theory. And they are now for the first time trying to figure out how to bring that out into the world. And that was really compelling to me, like bringing this depth into the world. And I can say for a fact that that was a difficult journey and that in some ways it failed, like in terms of actualizing what Ken Wilberth, the vision that he had. Like he was both a great CEO in the sense that he was a visionary and had this incredible vision and could encourage a lot of people to, you know, a lot of talented people to do cool stuff, but he was also not really well trained in how to like build companies and scale them up and create, you know, systems and stuff. Like he just didn't have that experience. And so in a way I watched what happens when you have this beautiful, deep idealism that isn't met by the same level of proficiency at like operational enactment. And that's part of what I learned from that period of time was like, you really have to have both going together. Otherwise it just doesn't work. But in retrospect, what that whole Integral Institute thing did was it created like a bazillion seeds that like went out and like I'm one of those seeds and many other people were touched by that community or in that community. And a lot of them have created really useful and functional things in the world that are informed by that. So it, even in failure, you know, there's success.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really resonate with that. And It would be an interesting topic to touch on. Something that I've thought about a lot in the past few years is like growing up, I was obsessed with this idea of autodidactism and just like learning every single thing on my own and just becoming like this Ken Wilber type person of just reading every single possible book about consciousness and Zen and systems and how do I integrate that all into like this master work. And as I've sought to develop myself, there's been this realization that if I don't have these feedback loops of other people like being like, oh, you're going down a rabbit hole here, or you're getting a little narcissistic with your ideas here, or this is a little bit detached from reality, or just without having people being able to check me like that, then my proposition is that it tends to lead towards egoism and narcissism more often than not.
Yeah.
And so Yeah, it's very fascinating to me what you shared about the Integral Institute and what does it look like to actually create those feedback loops and be able to as a collective make sense of what's happening and learn how to create different ways of making meaning, but not doing so in a way that either leads to spiritual cults or narcissism, or like this, it feels like there's a lot of traps to fall in with sense making and meaning making and scaling these psychotechnologies. And it feels like as I'm relating to these, it's like, oh yeah, of course we need more dialogues. Of course we need to like share what it is, the vision and what we're working on, and to get a little bit of pushback, or to, for people to ask questions, or for us to think about things maybe we weren't seeing.
Yeah, agreed. And well, I mean, Wilbur, in his own meta theory, this is what's so frustrating about such a good theory, is like you could see, the emphasis on transcending and including is right there in the theory. But of course, it's like hard to do that. Like in practice, you can kind of theoretically make space for that. But I think what you're saying is like you can't just go off on your own this infinite depth direction without eventually finding yourself alone and having no feedback, and then we get all fucked up, narcissistic, just distorted perception, loneliness that's crippling, animosity and all these things can arise when you're all by yourself out in some cul-de-sac that no one else has ever been to. It's like, well, like I want to invite my friends, to come and join me here, or like maybe I can show them at least where this thing starts, and if any of them are interested, they could do the journey themselves. Or like I think that's including others, and there's the whole function in Buddha, in Mahayana Buddhism, of wisdom and compassion, which is very similar. Like wisdom is that function that kind of brings us into the depths, and compassion is that movement toward including everyone in those depths. And both are important. And one without the other is sort of, again, like problematic, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it definitely caught me in that cycle. I found myself going, having this very strong desire for depth to the exclusion of compassion. And then there was like this wake up call I have of like, oh damn, like I kind of feel like I'm better than other people, and having delusions of grandeur and kind of this savior complex, and it doesn't feel good to be in that space, and also like for other people to receive that also doesn't feel good, and it's like it feels like more than ever now, it's like if I had to go deep, yeah, it's hard to justify in my mind going deep and sacrificing dialogue and compassion and group practices.
Nice. Makes sense to me.
Awesome. Yeah, so I think yeah, there was one last thought on the. Yeah, I'm not sure where to go with this, and I'm very curious about the thought that you mentioned on Integral Institute of, I mean, using his own model. There's a certain like green, teal or green yellow, like really trying to emphasize those stages of development, and then. What I see and experience is something that's frustrating to me is like a like what is an integration of orange or capitalism or that actually look like, because in every single circle I've been in, it's like that is I haven't seen almost any example of the orange stage being properly integrated or properly its insights being properly respected. And it's more of just like, yeah, we can just build a business around this, and then no systems ever get built, and it never ends up working. And it's like the actual, I think what I heard you pointing to is like the theory of orange, or the yeah, like the ideas are respected, but the implementation of a orange way of operating and building systems and strategizing seems to be like really difficult once you start getting into the space of green, deep human connection and understanding and that sort of stuff.
I think so. It is hard if you're still distancing yourself from those values and you haven't yet, you're still transcending them, but you haven't yet included them. It's very hard to operate in a systematic mode, which is a damn requirement for building an organization. You can't build a system that can grow and not just grow, but like can also adapt and evolve in a changing space. then yeah, it's all good ideas until you actually can do that. But if you only learn how to mix, and there are a lot of people who got really good at growing systems for their own, you know, just so they can make money, that's also insufficient, right? So yeah, there are people that have integrated these things, but I would say they're relatively rare, and you have to be willing to like listen and hear people's thinking around these things, not just immediately dismiss them because they're a capitalist, or immediately dismiss them because, you know, they're operating in a space that you think is, that it must be not ethical because they're doing this thing. And it's like, well, yeah, like some things that's true, but I've met a lot of entrepreneurs that seem to be holding these values as well, and working with the kind of reality of like, oh yeah, like we're operating in systems that are trying to maximize for financial capital. And you do have to acknowledge that and work within those parameters. And investors do want returns. But can you find the investors who can align with your way of thinking about it? They don't necessarily need a 100x unicorn. Maybe they'd be okay with like a 10 to 50x, you know, human organization, like one that's actually human scale and doesn't have to be like just a giant cancerous growth model. Yeah, I think those people exist too. And more people are finding, more people with capital are finding themselves growing into these kind of degrees of maturity where they get these things too. So I think the fact that there is this development, and it's cultural, it's not just like a handful of people, means that eventually, right, we're going to have the integral infrastructure and cultures that are needed to bootstrap and grow integral organizations. And I think we're at the very early stages of that, actually. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how much has changed in the meditation app space since I started doing this project. And when I was kind of first getting introduced to the space, like there was no venture capitalists who focused on mental health or well-being and who had like multiple bottom line mentality. And now there's like several. Mm-hmm. So there is more infrastructure actually for this kind of thing, which is really good news.
Yeah, such good news. Yeah, and it's what I'm hearing is there's like this subtle discernment, right? And it's like either it's not that capitalism is all bad or all good. It's like, yeah, there's a lot of bad incentives and there's a lot of potentially unethical things that happen as a result of capitalist incentives, and also that doesn't mean that the entire capitalist system is unethical. Yeah. And that's something I struggle with a lot. I've worked a lot in the marketing space, and marketing is this thing where there's a lot of unethical marketing techniques, and so often I see either people going full gung ho into let me just figure out how to get the most attention, or full rejection of it as all marketing is unethical. And I find myself trying to draw this line of what is ethical marketing? Is ethical marketing a thing? What does that look like? How can I make the distinction or discern between types of marketing that are really unethical? Because at the end of the day, what I landed on is like, it's very, very, it's like almost impossible to grow an organization without marketing. So you have to learn how to get people to see the thing. But how do you do that in an ethical way, I think, is a question worth asking.
It is. It is a question worth asking. And I'm thinking here of an author and writer named Venkatesh Rao. And he makes this interesting distinction between what he calls the premium mediocre and the actually good. And the premium mediocre would be like Starbucks. And the actually good is like your local coffee roaster, who like, you know, either grew or directly like knows the farmers they're sourcing the cocoa beans from and is in relationship to them. And, you know, it kind of has a full understanding of the ecological systems they're part of and is like not overtaxing them, et cetera, and is roasting them, who has a passion for the coffee bean, you know, like that's actually good. You mentioned gardening, like, and I'm also a gardener. Like growing your food and eating it is actually good. You know, going to the grocery store and getting like, you know, some produce that's like shipped in from Mexico or wherever, you know, that's not in season is like premium mediocre. the way I'm actually thinking about what we're building, interestingly enough, like with Interbeing, the app, it is a premium mediocre multiplayer meditation app. And the reason for that is because it's the premium mediocre that introduces people to the idea of something actually being good. It's like a gateway to the what's actually good. What's actually good is sitting with your friends. Hopefully you'll do this later, sitting with your friends and doing the practices together, and then like joking around about them afterwards, and like having, you know, having it feed back into your relationships in a way that really impacts you. It's premium mediocre is to go onto an app and do it with other people. But if this is your first time having experienced the premium mediocre version of social meditation, great. You know, I think that's a good overall, a good thing. And I'm willing to use certain kinds of awareness of how human body minds are to help effectively market these things, you know, to a point, because I know that these are good things to learn, and that I know where they lead. They're forward leading. So for that reason, you know, it's a sort of a question of like, yeah, sometimes the ends do justify the means, not always, but sometimes they do, especially when everyone else is using those means and using them effectively. You have to be able to play at those games. You have to understand like variable rewards and how they work, and understand that systems that have variable rewards are more kind of compelling, but at the same time, know where to draw the lines, you know, and what are they, those things in service of? Like, why are you hacking someone's system in order to teach them how to hack their own system better, or because you want to make a buck? You know, it's a very different outcome that you're aiming for there. And I think it changes the ethical calculus a lot.
Yeah, and it sounds like it takes a deep amount of honesty of where am I coming from? And I think there's a lot of ways we can delude ourselves of, oh, this is good for the world, when
sure,
really a deep, 1 second.
Yeah.
Car horn going off in the background.
Yeah, as it happens.
Yeah, it feels like it takes a deep level of integrity and honesty to be, where am I actually coming from? What are my motives? And can I be honest about what my motives are? And can I sit with the pain of, if my motive actually is just to make money, can I actually sit with that and be okay with that, and then and work with it rather than just deny it and create a lie, that lie to myself and say, oh, I'm doing this for the greater good. And I have never really heard it's been really hard for me to get out of the ends justify the means frame of, like, in my experience, there was just kind of this assumption that the ends never justify the
they
means.
Never,
they
right,
never
exactly
justify the
yeah,
means.
Yeah, well, that's an extreme position.
Right. And is there a... Yeah,
well, like, the other extreme would be they always justify them, which is also not true. Those are two extremes. Exactly. What is the middle way? You know,
what is the synthesis? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, it makes total sense as you're speaking, you know, like if everyone's on technology, everyone's going to be using these apps. Is there a way to create an app that is sticky? And the byproduct of using that app is that you get better at interpersonal practices, or you have a byproduct that is in service of something other than just you to use the product as much as possible.
Yeah. And like, what if part of the outcome of using it, the sticky product, is that you become more resilient in the face of those sticky triggers? Like, you actually become less manipulable.
Yeah, that would be a good outcome.
On net, I think it is a good outcome on net. And you're right. I mean, there's always that need to check against ego inflation. You know, I don't know if you've seen the show Billions, the TV show, but there's a billionaire on there named Michael Prince, and he is just a ruthless mother, you know, effer. But he presents it in the veneer of being really socially good. Like, it's like a purist veneer for like a ruthless mofo. Part of the show is really kind of pointing out like the the tension there between those two things and how they're really at odds in his case. And one is sort of, he's using this veneer in order to be even more successful and consolidate his power and influence even more, so that he can, you know, take over the world kind of thing. And, you know, I think it's important to be aware of that tendency as much as it is important to be aware of the tendency to become a kind of depth junkie, you know, and to just sort of be right, but ineffective. And, you know, it's like, yeah, how do we do that? I think you nailed it. Like, we have to have feedback. We have to have sources that we trust that can give us feedback about what we're doing and let us know when they think we've gone out. We need teachers, we need mentors, we need guides, we need coaches, we need friends, we need all the things, you know, so that we can do that. And that is very important.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it still lands, yeah, having feedback. Yeah, something that I think you were pointing to is, yeah, there's this, in the book 48 Laws of Power, there's a couple of laws which are basically like, you can't let other people know that you want power. You have to put on a veneer of generosity and of doing something good while hiding your real motives. And it sounds like that happened. I mean, it does happen in countless ways right now in the world. And it makes me question, like, how do we actually discern, you know, how do we actually, in my mind, it feels like what's needed is to question, yeah, like, what are these people's motives? Can I actually get curious about what their motives are and maybe not distrust? Yeah, it feels like there's just so many components to it of like wanting to trust people and also getting curious of,
yeah,
is the motive that they propose and talk about, is that their actual motive, and maybe not always just assuming that what they're saying is what the motive is underneath.
Yeah, and if I take the integral model very seriously, I still think it's one of the best things I've come across for describing what the hell is going on here. And part of that, you know, approach sort of says, hey, like, because we transcend and include, development is a process of transcending and including, all of these earlier value systems that we've grown up through are still operating in us. They're still valid needs. You know, we still have the need for success, the need for love and belonging, the need for pleasure and, you know, and avoiding pain. Like, all these things are still valid needs. And so what's the actual problem with that, trying to get multiple needs met at once, unless you think that one of those value sets is wrong and shouldn't exist? And that's just someone who hasn't found their way to an integral understanding yet, from my point of view. They're still at war with some aspects of the world and themselves. And so they haven't unlocked the full power of being able to get all of themselves rowing in the same direction for a single purpose. You know, and again, that purpose can be meeting multiple needs. Like, I want to create a successful company, not just because of the deep social vision and mission, but because also I have the need to take care of myself and my family and to pay for our mortgage and have an excess of capital to be able to give to friends and family and do fun stuff with and, you know, buy things. And, you know, all those things are still valid needs. And yeah, I'm going to acknowledge that. That's fine. What about you?
I feel that those needs are extremely valid.
I mean, I see a microphone in front of your face, and you got to pay for new microphones when they break.
Right. Yeah, I got to pay for this microphone. Got
to
pay.
And you
for
live in Boulder. Microphone. There's so much good food in Boulder. You got to be able to pay to go out once in a while. And
oh man, the farmers markets here, they're expensive, but holy so crap, expensive. They're good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. If we were in Europe, this would be less of an issue because all the, you know, the farmers markets are cheaper there, and food good food's easier to come by. But we're in America, so we actually, yeah, we have to in this case have extra financial capital or extra garden bed space, you know, to be able to do this.
Yeah. paying for a roof over my head, paying to go out to eat, paying to for groceries that are not cheap, and
books. These things are expensive.
Frick. But I didn't realize how expensive books are getting these days. And I just purchased a $35 book the other day, and I was like, God dang, how am I spending this much money on a single book? But
Yeah, no, I was looking back over my QuickBooks transactions and last year, and I'm like, wow, I have a problem. There's a lot of book purchases in here. I'm gonna have to do a tech startup just to pay for these books.
literally. Yeah, my reading list. I always have like five books on the list, and a lot of times I'll just pull the trigger on all five, and I'm like, dang, $150. Like $150 for some books is this the cost of groceries. I could make a grocery run with that, but
Feed the dragon.
gotta feed the mind and the body.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, it was such a pleasure speaking with you today, Vince.
You
And
too, Ethan.
I really appreciate your insights and your perspectives. And yeah, thank you for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been
Yeah. Do
fun.
you want to give the viewers a couple URLs of where they can find you, the Meditate with AI app, any of that stuff?
Yeah, so meditatewith.ai is where you can try the demo that we talked about. And if you want to sort of learn more about what I'm up to or kind of the various things that I'm connected to, I've got a personal site at vincehorn.space you can also check out.
Awesome. Well, it was such a pleasure, and yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.